Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. It's 1959 Part 2 here on Unpacking Peanuts, and we have another episode of really funny strips, really deep strips, and a lot of firsts. This is just a year of firsts. Schulz is at a new level. Just when it seems like he can't get any better, he manages to do just that. How are you guys doing? You doing good? Hope you're out there having a fun time. Thank you so much for listening to us. It means so much to me. I'm Jimmy Gownley. You might know me from talking in your ear every week. And otherwise, you might know me as a cartoonist. The cartoonist behind Amelia Rules, The Dumbest Idea Ever, and 7 Good Reasons Not to Grow Up. I'm going to be one of your hosts today, and joining me, as always, are my co-hosts. He's a playwright, he's a composer, both for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast. He's the creator of the very first comic book price guide. He's the original editor for Amelia Rules, and the current creator of such great comics as Strange Tractors, A Gathering of Spells, and Tangled River, Michael Cohen.
Hey there.
And he is the executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000. He's a former vice president of Archie Comics, and he's the creator of the Instagram strip Sweetest Beasts, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
So, guys, it's a banner year, 1959. We talked everyone's ear off last week. I think we just go right back to doing it again this week.
Sure.
That's always good.
Let's start right in with the strips. July 1st. Charlie Brown is standing, and he's talking to Linus. Charlie Brown says, "I thought having a baby sister would change my whole life, but it hasn't." Charlie Brown continues. This time he's leaning on a fence as Linus listens. "People still hate me. Nobody really likes me. I get just as depressed as I always did." Charlie Brown walks off with his head hung low. Linus says, "Poor Charlie Brown. Of all the Charlie Browns in this world, he's the Charlie Brownest."
That's got to be like a super classic line.
It is.
It must be in the movie. It must be in the TV specials.
It's in the Christmas special, but it's slightly changed and it's improved in the Christmas specials because he's not saying it to nobody. He's saying it to Charlie Brown, and he says, "Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest."
Is it Brownest or Browniest?
Browniest. Yeah. It's much better as "Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest." There you go.
Strangely enough, after not having a new character introduced for 5 years, Schulz introduces Sally and doesn't show her for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. They're just all talking about her, and the suspense starts building because you never get to see her. And we will.
Do you think that's because he's seen some of these people in the past with comic strips really building up tension and interest, like, you know, will they or won't they, Lil Abner and Daisy May, they're going to get married? Do you think he's doing this on purpose as a way to kind of build the tension?
Yeah, I definitely do. What's weird, though, about it is when it was reprinted, it reprinted some of them, but not all of them. So it does. So it sort of undercuts that feeling of tension building. And when you see them in the Fantagraphics books or gocomics.com, that's where you can, if you're out there listening right now and you want to follow along with us, you could go to gocomics.com, type in Peanuts, type in the dates that we're talking about, and you can read them. And when you do see all the strips in order, the way they're originally written, it does clearly, it was intending to build that tension and that surprise of when we finally see Sally. And for Amelia Rules fans out there, Karen Applegate Gownley is a huge Sally fan. It's her favorite character. So shouts out to Karen. July 5th. It's a Sunday, Paige. Linus is headed out to the field. We see him in the deep outfield with Schroeder, the catcher, and Charlie Brown back at home plate. Charlie Brown says to Schroeder, "Do you want to see a kid with a great throwing arm?" Charlie Brown tosses the ball in the air and then hits it out to Linus, who makes a classic Linus catch and then fires it home, knocking over both Schroeder and Charlie Brown and sending their clothes flying. We see hats, the chest protector, the face mask, and some shoes just ripped from their bodies. In the last panel, Schroeder is dazed. So is Charlie Brown, but Charlie Brown has a goofy grin on his face and says, "There's a kid with a great throwing arm."
Clearly a reference to Willie Mays. in the 1954 World Series.
Yeah, you know, whenever you see the other players on the team, it just really strikes you that their failures must all be Charlie Brown's failures. Right? I mean, Lucy's no good, but everybody else is pretty okay, and Linus is like an ace. So,
yeah, yeah, and, but I guess he's not a good batter because they often get zero.
Well, that's true. That is true. But yeah, you can't win if you don't score.
Yeah, yeah. I, you know, is this the first Peanut strip where the force is so great of a baseball going past someone that the shoes are knocked off?
I believe so. I didn't want to chat clock it super closely, but I don't remember seeing it before.
I love their socks though. The socks are not coming off yet. That's to come.
Great socks.
With the little, reinforced toe and heel. Yeah, it's great.
Really, really great drawing. July 18th. Schroeder and Lucy are hanging out at the piano. Schroeder is agitated, and he says to Lucy, "I wouldn't marry you unless you were the last girl on earth." Lucy leans in and says, "Did you say if or unless?" Schroeder says, "I admit I said unless." Lucy turns away and screams to the sky, "Hope!" I love that one. "I admit I said unless." I love that.
Schroeder's so formal when he's around her sometimes.
Well, and she is just gaining these little toe holds, just water on the rocks, just inching up a little bit. She admitted that, okay, you know, if Beethoven likes girls, there's a possibility you could. And now she got him to admit he said unless.
So if she were the last girl on earth, well.
Well, and as we saw last year with Linus concerned about the fallout, it could happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and you want an extremely annoying cartoonist observation?
Of course. That's what we're here for. That's the entire show, Harold.
No, you won't after I tell you what it is. It's so obnoxiously stupid. But so the one thing apparently that Schultz did not redraw every daily strip were the panels, right? He had those pre-printed. Right. I just was noticing, again, for no good reason, that the third panel is lower than the third and fourth panels are lower than the first and second panels. So this particular template, he didn't like exactly nail. I mean, you think if he was going to just do it once and reproduce it, he would have been even more of a stickler. As minimal as and stupid as it is.
Do you have a microscope or something? I don't see it.
Yeah, if you zoom in. Here's what I'll say to that. Oh, no, it's actually just wrong. Sized wrong. Oh, you're really, wow, that's nuts that you noticed that. But wow, you're right. What I was going to say is maybe they were just misaligned because this will make your blood go cold. When he would send these into the syndicate, he would just fold them in half in between the second and third panel. So I was thinking maybe there was some sort of problem with it and they got lined up wrong, but it's actually a different size panel.
Yeah. It's in like every single time it's that way. It's interesting. We can tell when he switches to a new template at some point when he fixes it, but right now it's just slightly off for some
reason. And the panels do change shape over time as well. I mean, not even when they're four panel strips, they change shapes.
Yeah. It looks like we'll see. Maybe someday it goes away.
July 28th. Linus is sitting speaking with Snoopy. He says, "I envy you, Snoopy. You don't have to worry about anything." Linus continues, "You don't have to worry about the future of the world or about inflation or about anything." Linus walks away, leaving Snoopy behind. In the last panel, Snoopy thinks to himself, "I wonder where my next meal is coming from."
The existential dilemma.
Yeah, and goes back to, you know, the kids looking at Snoopy as something other than them. But him saying, "Well, no, I have problems too."
Yeah, and that he's helpless, right? He's this domesticated beagle, and he is entirely reliant on someone bringing out that next meal.
Right. August 9th. Charlie Brown is sitting at a desk writing. It's Pencil Pal time. He starts, "Dear Pencil Pal, I guess by this time, everybody but you knows that I have a baby sister. I should have written sooner to tell you, but I have been very busy. Her name is Sally. We like her, and she likes us. Oh, says Charlie Brown, acknowledging something off-panel. We see him go to the refrigerator, take out a bottle of formula, put it on a formula heating device, 1959 model, standing there for a while. He tests it on his wrist, as one does with baby formula, walks off-panel with the bottle, then walks back onto panel without the bottle, and then continues writing. In a way, this has been a good experience for me. I have learned a lot. As ever, Charlie Brown.
I love this strip. I remember, again, one of the ones I remember is from a kid, being a kid. I don't know, just this silence of him going and doing this for his little sister. And he's, you know, he's a young boy himself, that he's taken on this responsibility. I just, like, you know, it's like cheers to Charlie Brown, that, you know, he's entrusted with this very important thing, and he's doing it. You know, he's succeeding in his small way of doing the right thing.
Well, it is very important. And if you get it wrong, you could hurt the baby, you know, but he's very diligent about it. And he tests it, make sure it's the right temp.
And it's like when there's nobody there to critique him on whether he does things right or wrong, it's just nice to see a little moment where just between him and his pencil pal, he's doing it right.
Yeah. Okay. So here's a couple things. How do you, the first time ever in the history of any comic strip, draw a bottle warmer? And how do you have the perfect, like, four line version of a bottle warmer just ready to go, that it's identifiable as such? That's the way he has mastered this style is amazing. But I say that so I could say I have no idea what is going on with panel, the third panel on the second tier, where Charlie Brown says, oh, is he trying to say, uh-oh?
That's what I thought it was.
I thought it was, uh-oh.
Oh, but that would be U-H-O-H, yeah. Right? Well, it wouldn't be O-H-O-H. Oh,
well, if it's O-O.
I mean, who says that? Must be a Midwestern thing. That's I'll just say for anything. I think it'd be uh-oh, and you were supposed to hear the baby crying, I guess, right? But
well, oh. I don't dare go into the etymology of uh-oh.
Uh-oh. Well, actually, we might as well just throw it out here. That was created by Albert Payson Terhune.
Good old Albert.
August 23rd. It's a baseball game, and we see Patty's there, Snoopy's wearing his hat, and Schroeder, dressed in his full catcher's gear, is talking to Charlie Brown. Schroeder says, "Where's all your stuff, Charlie Brown? Where's your glove and your bat and everything?" Charlie Brown says, "I can't play today." Patty and Schroeder are both confused by this. Schroeder says, "What do you mean you can't play today?" Charlie Brown answers, "Just what I said. I can't play today. There's something else I have to do." Patty comes over and starts talking to Charlie Brown, saying, "But you gotta play, Charlie Brown. You're our manager." Lucy's there now. Patty continues, "You may be a lousy manager, but you're still our manager." Lucy says, "We need you." Charlie Brown says, "I can't help it." Schroeder continues, "You gotta play, Charlie Brown. Patty, you gotta. Schroeder says, "I just don't understand it." Lucy says, "I understand it." Patty says, "You understand it? Since when did you become so understanding?" Lucy continues, "It's not a matter of understanding." And then we see in the final panel, Charlie Brown is pushing Sally in her stroller. He is sighing. And Lucy says, "It's simply the age-old story." So that's the first appearance of Sally visually.
And the joke is, she looks like him.
Which you would never really think about later, even though she does maintain the same facial features. But yeah.
There's so much in this strip, and you can tell that Schultz really was building to this strip. So how many days have we waited to see Sally? And then he compounds it with this revelation that Sally is the thing that is more important in Charlie Brown's life right now than baseball. That kind of echoes that previous strip, that there's something that is important about having a little sister that Charlie Brown takes very seriously, even though it may be things that have been told he has to do by his parents. But he does not take that lightly. He's not playing fast and loose. He gets tempted to do things and does that, you know, he does in future strips do some things he shouldn't do, but there's the side of Charlie Brown. And even the fact that the kids, you know, there's one mean thing said by, of course, Patty, but you know, nobody else is yelling at him. They're all saying, "We need you. We need you." And again, that's something you haven't heard in this strip before. Anybody saying, "We need you, Charlie Brown," and not being an April Fool's joke.
And of course, the one time they say it, he can't do it. So he doesn't get that satisfaction. Although they probably just need him to be there to be the goat, to be yelled at.
Well, yeah. And typically, I don't know, on Sandlot baseball, that why a manager couldn't be a manager, I guess, off they need another, an extra player, I guess, but that why couldn't he be the manager on the sidelines and the players?
Yeah, unless he has to take Sally someplace specific. That would be the only thing I could think of.
Right. Right. And this, the other thing about this strip, which I think is a first, and he certainly has led up to this is the first time you have a Sunday, which Charles Schulz had to draw, you know, weeks in advance of the dailies that he was doing. That he didn't do them in order in that way. The Sundays were always kind of separate from the dailies in his routine, but he specifically makes a point of drawing this strip early and then holding back on the dailies so that the Sunday strip actually leads into the storyline on Monday. And we haven't seen that before.
And it's funny, I think you can tell that because Sally is about 150% cuter when we see her the next time. You know, it's just she's got that big jaw 1956 or whatever look in that last panel, and then when you see her in the next daily, it's just a classic cute Peanuts look.
Yeah, she's really cute in the Monday.
This is a time, a strange thing also, morphing this story into, I mean, the Sally story into another story. So it kind of went from baseball to Sally's feelings back to baseball.
Yeah. And this boy, this is typical. We have a little baby girl being introduced, and by the third strip, she is in distress. You know, it didn't take long. This little sweet, adorable baby is having to deal with.
Schulz must have felt the need to have another baby character.
And he does have the two baby girls. You know, he's got the 1 and the 3-year-old now that he hasn't had a chance to mess around with much since growing Lucy up.
Well, why don't we see what her distress is? August 26th, we see Charlie Brown pushing Sally. Patty and Linus are in the background. They look nonplussed by this. Patty says, "I hope she's satisfied." Patty continues, "Depriving us of a manager just before our last and most crucial game." Patty continues, "All because she has to ride around in her old stroller. Well, I just hope she's satisfied." In the last panel, we see Sally being pushed in the stroller, and she's thinking to herself, "My first year in this world, and already I have guilt feelings."
So Schulz says his babies are sort of born with like fully developed English thoughts. Because she's clearly like 2 weeks old. But that works. I mean, it works every time he's done it.
And it's interesting that everybody is intolerant about this, except for Lucy and Charlie Brown. I mean, he's just saying this is the reality. And Lucy's like, this is the reality.
She has a brother, a little baby. She has a baby brother.
And that's, again, this is an aspect of Lucy that we haven't seen before. Usually she's the one who's this flying off the handle, the most, you know, just hard on her sleeve. If she feels a certain way, you're going to know about it. And she's less introspective. And I think this is, again, a cool moment with seeing both Charlie Brown being a responsible person. That's, you know, he was so upset about forgetting his library book earlier this year. And now he's got to take care of his little sister. And that's just the way it is. He's accepting.
Well, it's a profound change actually in the character. And I think as the decades go on, Charlie Brown becomes more paternal to the other characters. And I think you see it kind of starting right here. Even to the point when they're saying, we need you, you know, you're not here for us. Maybe they're learning that for the first time, that it's maybe not even about the winning and the losing, but it's just about the ritual of this is who we are and what we do. And how are you how dare do you say that you're changing that now?
And maybe that's another reason why we lose Shermie.
Yeah.
Because the one thing Shermie seemed to have on these kids is he was the older kid with the older kid perspective. And if Charlie Brown starts to take on some of that, Shermie's even less needed than before.
Yeah. And you know, it is sort of funny, like going back to the bottle warming strip. He is, even though he's the character that everything goes wrong for, he can't fly the kite, he loses all the baseball games, he is the character that you would trust to do something like that for some reason.
Yeah, when it counts.
Yeah, when it counts. Right. Yep. I mean, these are subtleties of personality that are crazy that they exist in these little postage stamp sized comic strip panels.
Well, but keep going, because he kind of does put baseball ahead of his job.
In a great scene. All right. So let's, that's a couple strips ahead. So I'll just read, let me just read one more of these Sally ones and then we'll go to that one. So how about August 27th? Charlie Brown is standing. He's watching the baseball team from a distance. He says, "There's my baseball team out there getting clobbered." He continues, "And here am I, their manager, forced to watch them go down to defeat because I can't play." He turns and yells at his baby sister. "And why can't I play? Because I have to push my baby sister around." And last panel, Sally looks out at us and thinks to herself, "Nobody likes me."
Oh, man.
It's genetic.
Genetic, yeah. Right. It's exactly what I was going to say. Oh, man, that's so funny. So that leads us to August 31st in this continuing story. In panel one, we see Charlie Brown pushing Sally in the stroller, but he's doing it at a great clip. In the second panel, we see he has brought her back to the front steps of his house and says, "I'm sorry, I can't push you anymore, Sally, but I have to go save my team from defeat." He runs off wearing his glove and brandishing his bat like Excalibur. "Hang on, team. Here comes your faithful manager." In the last panel, we see Sally sitting alone in her little stroller, thinking to herself, "I had no idea that life was going to be filled with such drama."
So question for you guys. Why does Charlie Brown take her and abandon her outside her home rather than keep her with him at the baseball?
I assume it has to be that. I think, okay, this is like where the story and the rules that Schultz is working with conflict. Because I think what he's supposed to be doing is taking Sally home. So like right off panel would be her parents. But we can't see them in the strip, right? But that's what that's signifying. That not that he's just letting her sit there in the stroller. And why you can't do that, I will tell you this. In the famous Wiffle Ball World Series, Jackie Swearhart had to babysit his sister, Heather. And I remember her very clearly standing on the back porch, because the Wiffle Ball Series was in my friend Mark's yard. And she was eating a cookie. She wasn't even eating it. She was just a toddler. So she's just like sucking on a cookie and turning it into cookie mush. We used to...
Arrowroot biscuits.
Yeah. And someone hit a line drive with just a wiffle ball and hit the cookie in her hand, and it shattered in a million places. She screamed and cried. They're playing hardball, so you can't leave a kid.
Hard wiffle
ball. Well, no, we were playing wiffle ball. They're playing hardball, so that would hurt if she got hit with that. So she has to stay home.
Well, it's interesting that you assume that the parents are right there, that he's not being irresponsible in that way. He may have shortened or sped up his time that he had obligated, but he actually fulfilled
four panels.
Most of his obligation.
Yeah, right. That's what it is. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. He has to achieve that. And he only has one panel to describe what is happening there. Right. It's amazing. So, yeah, that to me is shorthand for he brought her home.
OK, so he's faithful son and faithful manager here.
And terrible at baseball, though, so it's not going to matter anyway. September 14th. Charlie Brown is racing, trying to get a kite up in the air. Shermie and Linus look on. Charlie Brown runs right into a tree. Wham! Shermie and Linus run after to see what's happened to their friend. In the last panel, we see Linus and Shermie carrying Charlie Brown, who seems dazed, home on his kite. And Shermie says, "In the olden days, this was known as bringing the warrior home on his shield." Shermie gets to say something. This
get the thermometer out.
Yeah, this is like the second thing Shermie got to do all year.
We have to analyze it.
Let's check the thermometer, Charlie Brown.
Let's call it. All right, what does this indicate to you in Shermie's personality? Does this give him something?
Well, he's historically knowledgeable. He knows his history.
He's the historian of the strip.
Yeah, he's a historian. He's a history buff.
Yes,
that's great. All right, well, I'm writing that down. So, for those of you playing at home, as of 1959, according to the Shermometer, Shermie is a history buff who is empathetic, aggressive, compassionate, patient, pedantic, emotional, a good listener, he's vain, good friend, and a hypocrite.
That's the stuff of drama.
That is how you make a good character over the course of 9 years. People say Shermie has nothing. He has a lot. But it all comes down to that base. He is a hypocrite. It's my favorite part of the show. And we only have a few years left of Shermie. By the end of the 60s, he's out.
No.
One reference.
He gets laid off.
And that's it.
Oh. Maybe Shermie was really Jim Sassoville.
Oh, too soon. Too soon.
Yeah.
September 20th. Violet is screaming out to someone, "You're a 14-carat blockhead." She continues, "You're stupid. You've always been stupid, and you'll always be stupid." She continues, "You're a cheat and a liar and a fool." In the next panel, we see Lucy seems to be the person who is taking the brunt of Violet's attack this time. Charlie Brown and Linus look on. Charlie Brown says, "Boy, just listen to those insults. Violet has Lucy speechless. She really knows how to dig her." Now Violet is coming towards Lucy. "You have a face like a goat. No, I take that back. You look more like a baboon." Charlie Brown continues talking to Linus. "Just listen to her. I'm glad it's not me she's yelling at. I'd never be able to take it." Linus says, "She's good, all right. There's no denying that. But just wait until they get up close." We see Lucy stern-faced as Violet approaches. Then, when they get nose to nose, Lucy leans in and says, "You're a no good, tail tattling little sneaking snip snap ponytailed ape." Violet walks off. She looks devastated. Lucy is quite proud of herself. And Linus says, "Nobody can beat Lucy at infighting."
Well, we've often wondered who would win in a match between the two. And now we know. Clear knockout.
Now, what do you think of this one, Harold?
I don't know what to say. It's well told, it's defining the characters well. And because this strip has gotten so, I don't know, rich and diverse, this just stands out again as, you know, it's a major moment of strong emotion, but it stands out from the other strips and yet it fits in the world. I'm just in awe of where all the places Charles Schulz has taken us this year.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
You know, I would love, part of me is so tempted to just do a rough of this for one of my next books and submit it to the editor as if it's my own, just to see them lose their minds. You cannot have one child call another child a baboon. Having said that, here's what I would have done. If old Sparky came to me and said, Hey, Jimbo, I need your help on this one. Here's what I would do. The next to last panel, "You're no good, tail tattling, little sneaking, snip, snap, ponytailed ape." That's not really a great insult or anything. I would have Violet come right up to Lucy and I would have Lucy whisper something to Violet that we can't hear.
Yeah.
Mm. And then I'd have Violet walk off and Linus say, "Nobody can beat Lucy at infighting." Because then whatever you're thinking she says,
wow,
it's way horrible than.
I think Jimmy may have just out Schulz.
Yeah, that would have been good. But I think it has something to do with all those little dashes in there. I think it has something to do with, I think she's speaking that really fast. I mean, faster than.
Oh, anyone. Right. Well, so this goes back to that conundrum of how do you convey someone speaking quickly? But I think, yeah, because she is going for the, Schulz is going for the italicized lettering there. So we're definitely seeing something different than just force, because force is usually done with bold lettering.
Yeah, what would you, I mean, she's right up in her face. So you, and the term infighting is kind of odd at the end. I mean, when I think of infighting, I think of people who are with, you know, supposedly working together on something and they are going after each other. I'm not sure why Linus uses that term.
I think it's a boxing term.
Oh, okay.
Let me look it up. Yeah, fighting or boxing at close quarters. Yeah, so it's a boxing term.
Fighting at close quarters. Okay. Well, that's cool. I did not know that. And there this is go. A good a time as any to bring up the anger index.
Yes.
For 19- oh, very good. 59. Oh, that's great. Because I have a surprise for you guys. All right, go for it, cool. Harold.
All right, so how does this year feel compared to 1958 for you in terms of anger? And again, for those of you listening, the way I'm doing this, I'm going through the strips and in my own subjective way, trying to see if it, at least one panel, there is a character showing the emotion of anger in a strip. And then I count of all the strips that have at least one of those incidences. And then I do a percentage of the year to see how many people, or how many strips have anger in them. And then we compare it to previous years to kind of see if Schultz is going a certain direction.
It's got to be way down. I'd say 81.
I'm going to go with 237.
Whoa.
I don't know. I'm terrible at this.
All right. You're really close, Michael. 94 of the strips show anger, down from 150 in 1958. So again, that this kind of plays into my theory that moving to California is a good thing for Charles Schultz in terms of some of the pent up stuff that's going on. Maybe in this sprawling estate, somehow with this family now, a little more isolated than, you know, his coworkers over at the art instruction schools. He's no longer attending the church he'd been in for years and had gotten very involved in. That maybe things have expanded a little for Schultz and things are getting a little more subtle. There's not as much anger. That's a theory.
However, he's not sacrificing depth.
No.
You know, it's not like it's just turning into
the opposite. Kittens,
right. The opposite. Well, here's something.
I'll let you switch over to your anger thing. But I did want to just do the happy thing to plays into what you're saying.
Oh, sure,
about
please,
the depth. Yeah. So the happy index in 1958, we had 47% of the strips showing someone with happiness. And that was up from 34% in 1957.
Right, we're doing so percentages or number of strips.
Okay, let me put it this way. There were 170 strips in 1958. 47% of the strips had a character showing happiness. Do you think that goes up or down this year?
I think that's down 2. I think we've got...
Yeah, I'm gonna go with 11.
I'll go with 23. I think he's using subtler emotions here than happy, angry.
Yeah, you're right. It is down. It's 155 down from 170. So in relationship to anger, it's higher by far than it's ever been. But he just had the stakes higher in 1958. Everyone was, that's why I called that year kind of strident. But mm-hmm. I think this year things are really becoming a lot more subtle. He's introducing a lot of new angles, and it just seems like the strip's opening up. And that's a major, major shift in just one year.
It really is. So I wanted to do something because I thought, well, this is interesting in and of itself, but how does that compare to other strips?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other strips from the 50s and what, you know, that were contemporaries, and what would the anger index be on that? So I decided for your edification that I would read the entire 1959 run of BC comic strips and I would chart the anger in BC. I failed. I could only get 6 months into BC, and that was rough. That was rough. One BC strip in 1959 literally has an ant, the bug, an ant, being executed by hanging for crimes he committed. I was like, you know what? I don't know how many more of these I can do. But in 6 months, there were 52 BC strips that were angry. So what does that mean?
So that's 104 for the year, which would
be, if you extrapolate it out, yeah,
slightly higher than Schultz this year, but down from his previous year. So.
Yeah. So there you go.
There was more to be angry about in the Stone Age. I guess dinosaurs, so. As you know.
<It's> now.
Right. Yeah. And talk about a strip that, again, drawing wise, really, really shows that someone's looking at Peanuts.
Oh, boy. It was shocking to me. The line quality, especially, and mm-hmm. the simplicity of it, and the idea of coming back again to these recurring things. It's a heavy, heavy Peanuts influence.
Yeah. I have a collection of strips from, I think it was 58 or 9 from BC. And I definitely, they're my, I think it's my favorite era of BC is the really early stuff, which is often the case. You know, it's sunny. So many strips come out strong. It's like Hollywood Squares syndrome, right? You see all these people like who the heck is Charlie Weaver and people that you didn't know for anything being famous other than they were on Hollywood Squares, and you're like, why on earth is this person famous? Mm-hmm. And then you go back and you see some routine that somebody had done at the beginning of their career that made them famous. You're like, that's why they're famous. But it's you're just seeing a shadow of it later on. I think a lot of comic strips were like that, that while Schultz built and built and built and built, a lot of artists, I think, came out of the gate strong. And you can see why a syndicate editor bought the strip. And then it's like they just lose interest. They don't know how to continue to make it interesting for themselves.
It is funny. I think when we were talking to William Pepper, well, I said, oh, Schultz seems really enthusiastic at this point, whatever it was like a strip from the 60s. And he said, well, yeah, I don't think it's enthusiasm. It's that he had wanted to do this his whole life. It's like, yeah, that lasts until 1952, right? And then you're faced with the reality of this is a job, and it is an unrelenting job, yeah. You know, that just goes on and on and on and on and on. So it makes much more sense that people would get burned out than people would be starting to become even more inspired like he is. Now, he is also getting massive rewards for it. That's a part that you can't ignore.
Yeah, he's somehow is because of his nature, he evens things out and he's pacing himself, but he's constantly getting rewarded for what he's doing. And I think it just continues to encourage and make him more determined. Another thing William Pepper brought up was Garfield. I don't know if you guys read much of the early Garfield strip, but it's very different in tone. It seems more sophisticated. It seems the drawing looks like Kleiben cats instead of the Garfield we know.
It's what is a Kleiben cat? You mentioned that, and that I have no idea what that is.
Oh, why don't you Google it?
Why don't you Google it? Harold Obscurities explained.
Kleiben, he was very popular around the time. I mean, there's no question that Jim Davis was basically taking this artist's work. There's a famous little drawing of this cat. He was used a lot in merchandising. I don't know what his origins are. We can't Google it. But there's one where he's like, he's singing a little song. He's like, oh, I love to eat the little mousies. I like to nibble their little toes. It's this kind of Edward Gorey kind of cat. It's kind of hard to describe. It was extremely popular, I think, in licensing. Like you see pillows and mugs and things of this. But where he came from, it's a very good question. I don't know. But you see that influence in Garfield. And then in time, I think the way Jim Davis dealt with it was, says, I see that this is appealing to a lot of people. And like Schultz, it's appealing to younger people. And in Garfield became its own massive phenomenon in the early 80s. Everyone had a Garfield doll and an Odie doll if they were really into it. And it's like he just made a decision, okay, I'm going to standardize my strip and I'm going to hire people to support me. And we are going to make a standardized product of Garfield, and we'll make him cuter and we'll make him rounder. And that was a successful commercial choice of his. Artistically, I guess you could say there's a sameness to it because it's standardized. Because that's the danger of Schultz. He's going off into these new directions, and maybe people don't like where he's going. Every time he takes a chance with that, he might alienate.
Yeah, it's a risk every time. Else. It really
and
is.
And yet Schultz pulled it off over and over and over again for so many readers over such a long period of time, even though the strip changed massively.
Right.
You know, it's like there was an integrity to it that people respected it at the least, even if they didn't like certain eras, it seems.
Absolutely. September 25th. Snoopy is staring at a tree as some leaves fall. Snoopy thinks to himself, if I were a leaf, you'd never catch me falling off a tree. Then we see Snoopy gripping tight to the tree. He thinks, I'd hang on for dear life. I'd stay with that tree until they came to get me. Now Snoopy is even more distraught as he mimes being pulled off the tree. He thinks, even then they'd have to drag me off. I'd kick and scream and put up a real fight. Then in the last panel, he calmly thinks to himself, I'd make a lousy leaf.
Considering how many strips Schultz did on this theme, I happen to really like the leaf strips. But imagine him telling the editor, like, I've got a great idea for a bunch of strips. The dog punching a leaf falling falls off the tree.
Yeah, you can't get more minimal than that, really, right?
Can you imagine if that was just sold as a daily and well, torture you'd go
I don't know how many leaf strips he had. You'd probably put a book together.
Well, there is, like I said, there is a on gocomics.com, they have a curated collection of just the leaf strips. I don't think it's all of them, but it's a representative sampling, which is another really nice thing. It's crazy that we're able to do this. And it costs nothing to read every single one of these strips. And although I am encouraging all of you to go out and buy the Fantagraphics books, to go on gocomics.com and just read them for free and have little curated lists like that, it's fantastic.
Should we encourage somebody to publish that compilation of leaf stories?
Be amazing. Here's what you do. You put a little gift book of it together and you sell it at
Hallmark
or coffee shops when the pumpkin spice lattes come out.
That's right. Well, what would you call that collection?
I have no idea. Wouldn't it be great if I thought of something really funny, like Zip right there? That would have been amazing. But I have no idea.
Spend a week thinking about it and we'll edit it.
We'll edit it in later. That sounds perfect. October 5th. Linus and Charlie Brown are standing outside. Linus looks very happy and content. Charlie Brown says, I hear you kind of like your new teacher, Linus. Linus says to Charlie Brown, Charlie Brown, I have the greatest teacher in the whole world. She's a gem among gems. Linus sighs. And then in the last panel, he says, I never realized that the National Education Association turned out such a fine product.
Miss Othmar is one of the greatest characters who never appeared in a comic.
Great character.
Yeah. It's the Carlton, your doorman of comic strips.
And of course he does this, you know, the parents are never seen, famously the little red-haired girl.
Yeah, yeah.
And Miss Othmar. October 8th. Lucy is yelling at Linus, who looks super happy and content. She says, you always overdo things. Linus tries to walk away, but Lucy comes after him, still heckling him and saying, it's all right to like a teacher, but it's wrong to worship her. Linus says, I never said I worship her. Then he continues saying, I just said that I'm very fond of the ground on which she walks.
Yeah, this strip, I fond memories of this as a kid. It's funny, Jimmy, when you drew me for the Unpacking Peanuts logo, that first drawing of Linus is like, oh, that's pretty close. And Lucy starts to become a bit of a voice of reason sometimes. You know, she's harsh, but she's got some insight, right? It's, instead of saying, you know, that the moon is made of green cheese, she's now saying some things that may have some helpful insights. If she could be listened to.
It's interesting. Yeah. She sort of understands the interior life of people, but she does not understand the world around her very well.
Yeah. It really is a fascinating character. And, you know, if in a strip, someone was speaking reason to somebody, like, you know, the psychiatry booth thing, sometimes what she says has truth to it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes maybe not so much, but you know, it seems like Linus in ways benefits from having an older sister given his personality.
Yeah. Of course, his personality is also formed by having that older sister.
That's true. Yeah. Would he have the blanket if he did?
Yeah, probably. It's a chicken or the egg scenario. Who knows? October 22nd. Sally is playing with her bottle on the ground in her house and Snoopy is watching her. She spins it around. The bottle points at Snoopy, who then in the last panel leans out for a big kiss, surprising and dismaying Sally. I love the art in this strip. I think this is great cartooning.
I laughed out loud reading this one. I just thought it was hilarious. Both characters are incredibly cute.
So cute. October 24th. Snoopy is lying inside his doghouse at night, and he's thinking to himself, "Sometimes I lie awake at night wondering why I was born. Why was I put on this earth? What am I doing here?" By panel three, he's on top of the doghouse, and he thinks, and then suddenly it hit me. In panel four, we see him laying on his stomach on top of the doghouse, and he thinks, "I haven't got the slightest idea."
Existential.
As Schultz comes back to this again and again, where Snoopy is the person that punches holes in philosophy, where later on he'll write a theology book with the title, "Has it ever occurred to you that you could be wrong?" And, you know, this is it too. You know, you can contemplate this all you want, but the reality is you don't have the slightest idea. October 25th, Sally crawls up to Linus, who is sitting in his classic thumb and blanket pose. Snoopy walks up as well. We have multiple panels of Linus, who first he looks at Sally, then he looks at Snoopy, and he knows something's going on, but he decides to just let it go. And in the moment where he closes his eyes in contentment again, Sally kisses him on the cheek, and Snoopy steals the blanket. Linus is shocked. His hair shoots straight up in the air. He looks around. Both are gone now, and he walks over and finds his sister. He sits down next to Lucy and says, "If you can't trust dogs and little babies, whom can you trust?"
It's cute.
And this is the first time we see Sally's proclivity toward a romantic relationship with Linus.
Yeah, it's the first time they're alone together, and she gives him a little kiss on the cheek. Really cute drawing, really cute baby stuff. He obviously, I mean, going back even to the Sally with the milk bottle spinning it around, I mean, it looks a little less like a Peanuts body and a little more like maybe Schultz was looking at a real toddler's body.
Yeah, and it's adorable what he does in the second tier, the first two panels. Linus, you know, he's doing the side eye to Sally, who's got this innocent, sweet little smile looking in his eyes. And then he side eyes to Snoopy on the other side. And then Snoopy gives the sweet little smile. It's just really, really cute that he just is kind of silently playing out these characters, and that they're supposedly ganging up, or at least Snoopy is taking advantage of what's about to happen with Sally.
Great, masterful cartooning.
Character and the characters again. Although we're introducing something new with Sally, because I know that that's where Sally goes with Linus. It's like, wow, this is, you know, he's really playing with his characters. He knows them well.
October 26th, Linus is writing a letter. Lucy is watching. She says, "What in the world are you doing?" Linus says, "Don't you know? This is the time of year when we all write to the Great Pumpkin and tell him what we want for Halloween. The Great Pumpkin loves little children. I can see him now rising up out of the pumpkin patch with his big bag of toys."
First Great Pumpkin.
Great Pumpkin. Another one of the great themes. I mean, and this is up there with the psychiatry booth. This is something that the whole world knows that just came out of this comic strip. Amazing.
Yeah. And this ran for a week or so. Mm-hmm. The Great Pumpkin stuff.
Right, yeah. And we've just gone through a whole series of strips, like one after another, because he's getting so good here in October. The one we skipped is maybe the clue as to where Schultz got the germ of the idea of the Great Pumpkin, which I think is really fascinating. In October 23rd, Charlie Brown has said, "I've never been so mad in all my life," because he goes to get a Halloween mask more than a week before Halloween, and they're busy putting up the Christmas decorations. He can't find a Halloween mask. I was like, oh, that maybe was where he made the jump to having a Christmas celebration in Linus's mind go back to Halloween.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have a long, detailed, philosophical paper on the Great Pumpkin that I could read, but I think I'm going to save that for a later Great Pumpkin.
Cool.
So stay tuned, you blockheads. November 12th. Lucy is skipping rope. "You, a doctor?" she says to Linus. "Ha, that's a big laugh." She stops skipping and then just confronts Linus and says, "You could never be a doctor. You know why?" She resumes skipping rope, saying, "Because you don't love mankind. That's why." Linus yells after her, "I love mankind. It's people I can't stand." That's a famous one.
This became a famous saying.
Yes.
And its origin is here, you believe.
It's one of those things, like there's a famous thing about the band The Velvet Underground, another modern reference, where it was like only 2,000 people bought the first record, but everyone who did formed a band. And I've seen that quote attributed to everybody, right?
Albert Payson Terhune.
Yeah, right. Of course. Yeah. Well, that's the original.
How could Mark Twain not have said this?
Well, I know. And then later on, I know it's attributed to Jerry Seinfeld as like, you must have a comedian has to have a great love of humanity and hate every single person he met. So there are other examples of it, but I think this is definitely where it comes from.
Amazing.
And yeah, and boy, this is one of those strange insights from Lucy where you're like, it's harsh. And she doesn't love mankind, but that's okay.
Yeah, because she's not trying to be a doctor.
Right. She's just skipping rope. It doesn't matter to her.
November 29th. Snoopy is crouching amid the long grass. He thinks to himself, here's the fierce mountain lion sneaking through the grass.
In the next panel, we see him leaping over the underbrush, saying, here's the agile mountain lion bounding through the underbrush. Now he's standing on top of a rock, thinking, here's the proud mountain lion sitting atop a rock. In the next panel, he has a ridiculous look on his face and his ears prick up because he thinks to himself, suddenly he sees an approaching figure. It's Charlie Brown. Snoopy ducks behind the rock and thinks to himself, he crouches behind the rock. He then springs on Charlie Brown, thinking, he leaps as he makes the noise, grog. He then lands on Charlie Brown's head. And for two panels, just hops up and down on Charlie Brown's head as Charlie Brown stands there, just befuddled by the entire thing. Then in the third panel, he stops, leans over so he could look at Charlie Brown in the eyes, then walks away, sighing to himself. In the last panel, Charlie Brown is writing to his pencil pal, and he says, dear pencil pal, on my way home from school today, I was attacked by a mountain lion. I was not seriously injured.
Just to remind our listeners, Snoopy has not given up on his impersonations because that was a big thing in the 50s. So this year he was a gopher, a bloodhound, a vampire bat, big man on campus, and a mountain lion.
Amazing. And this is all, you know, Snoopy's later more famous guises, you know, like Joe Cool or the Flying Ace or the Writer, all evolve out of this initial impulse to try to mimic first the other characters and then, you know, different animals and stuff like this. And this is a great one. I mean, I love the panels of Snoopy jumping up and down on Charlie Brown's head. It just legitimately makes me laugh.
I mean, it's got one classic drawing after another. Yes. He's got the incredibly intense Snoopy in the very first panel in the thicket of weeds looking like he's going to cause trouble. On the very next panel, he's got little blissy Snoopy bouncing off of a rock, but he's somehow parallel to the ground, like he's about to fall on his face, but he's somehow going to recover quickly. And then you have the proud Snoopy in the next panel sitting on top of a rock. And then you have this weird Jay Wardish Bullwinkle Snoopy.
That one cracks me up.
That's hilarious. And then I love the next one where he's got his little snout peeking over the rock. And his mouth is way forward, like it's like he's somehow made his smile to sit on top of the rock. And then the pounce on the next strip is, again, a classic first. I don't think I've seen this version of Snoopy pouncing with the teeth the way it is there. And then in next panel, he's jumping up and down on Charlie Brown's head, who is entirely emotionless beneath. And he continues in the next panel. And then I love the next panel where it's Snoopy sitting on top of Charlie Brown's head, now emotionless and looking at the emotionless Charlie Brown, looking straight into his eyes, and Snoopy's ears hanging straight down. Anybody who can get access to the November 29th, 1959 strip, take a look at this thing. Because even when Snoopy walks away depressed with his Cigar, it's also classic Snoopy. It's like he nails panel after panel after panel of all these different versions of Snoopy. It's so amazing. The cartooning just blows me away.
And what's so strange, what so unique about it and interesting, I think, is like, you know, previous to this, you're thinking the great Sunday pages are, you know, Prince Valiant, the beautiful Flash Gordon pages by Alex Raymond, you know, stuff like that. They would take a whole week to do a Prince Valiant page. This was probably drawn in an afternoon. Well, it was definitely drawn in an afternoon. So quickly, so minimally, but no line is ever wrong.
Yeah, he's at the top of his game here. And this looks like the classic Peanuts to me.
For sure.
There's nothing out of line with this. I wouldn't know if this was a 1965 strip 6 years later necessarily. I mean, just from my memory, it's Peanuts.
Yeah.
I'd love a t-shirt with Snoopy looking down on, standing on Charlie Brown's head, looking at him with his head down 180 degrees.
So cute. December 2nd, Charlie Brown is talking with Lucy outside. He seems to be a little agitated. He says, "Look, you don't have to tell me I'm blah. I know I'm blah." Lucy answers, "Well, then there's still hope for you, Charlie Brown." She continues, "If you recognize this in yourself, then that's the first step up from blahdom." In the last panel, we see Charlie Brown alone as he looks out to us and asks, "Blahdom?
How did this not become a catchphrase?" I don't understand.
Is this the first time that Schultz does the Charlie Brown repetition of some strange phraseology of the other cast members? Because he does it over and over again. I think this may be his first time with Charlie Brown doing that.
Here's what I think, though. Way back when we started this podcast, I did a little thing that said, "And we'll be charting the firsts. And here's how we chart the first." Is this the first? Does anyone know? Has anyone ever read this? Is this it? We literally have every year we go, "Is this the first?"
That's because we get nailed every time we say it is.
No idea. Well,
but I will say,
April
6th, I saw it for the first time, not with Charlie Brown, but with Lucy did it the first time. And that's when Linus calls Lucy Mommy O.
Oh, yeah.
There's a couple of beat references.
Yeah.
From Linus that year.
Yeah. You know, I get that he would be simpatico to the Beats, and I get that the Beats would be simpatico to him. I mean, you cannot think of people further apart on every other life spectrum, but the existential questioning and the, you know, well, I mean, it's the Beats, you know, so the beat down nature of Charlie Brown, I think, vibed with them.
Yeah.
December 13th, Charlie Brown is sitting in a chair reading a book. He looks at the clock and says, 5 o'clock, time to feed the dog. He then makes a bowl of food for Snoopy and brings it out to him in the backyard, saying, "Okay, Snoopy, here you are." Snoopy immediately jumps to attention and sings. Well, does he sing, or do I just think of him as singing? At the very least, he's saying, "Oh, it's supper time. It's supper time. Supper time, supper time, supper time." Now he's dancing with Charlie Brown, saying, and Charlie Brown says, "Hey, cut it out now. Watch what you're doing." But Snoopy continues dancing around the dazed Charlie Brown. "Oh, it's supper time. It's supper time." He continues, "It's supper time. Oh, yes, 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 yes. It's supper time. It's supper time. It's..." Charlie Brown's had enough and just screams, "All right, eat." Good grief. Charlie Brown walks away, leaving a dazed Snoopy. Snoopy then starts eating his dinner, saying, "So what's wrong with making mealtime a joyous occasion?"
So is this the first Super Supper Time dance?
Well, it's the Supper Time dance, but yeah. Google the song Summertime. Summertime, summertime, summertime.
See if it lines up. Let's do that. All right. I'll check it out. See if that lines up.
That's what I'm hearing in my head.
That would be cool. And the living is easy, but I don't think that's what
we're doing. And the living is easy. The living's never easy for Charlie Brown. December 20th. Linus is checking himself out. He has a new pair of slacks on, and he says, "Yes, sir. Long pants sure do make the man." He then walks over to Lucy. He's holding a tie in his hand, and Lucy is dressed up in a fancier than normal dress. And he says, "Well, how do I look?" Lucy says, "Fine. It's the first time I've seen you in a white shirt in 6 months." Lucy continues as she's putting on her shoes. Now, are you sure you know your piece for the Christmas program? Linda says, I know it backwards and forwards and sideways and upside down. I could say it in my sleep. Lucy is now fixing her hair in the mirror. Yeah, well, I remember last year, you almost goofed the whole program. Linda says, well, this is this year, and this year I won't forget. Linus demonstrates by saying, and the angel said unto them, fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. Then Lucy says, say, that's pretty good. Linus puts his coat and hat on and says, I told you I knew it. I have a memory like the proverbial elephant. As he's walking out the door, he continues, well, I'm going on ahead to the church. I'll see you there. The snow falls as he's walking towards church and he's rehearsing. For behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. What a memory. The next panel, Lucy's still putting her coat on, but Linus is back. And Lucy says, what in the world? I thought you just left. Linus says, I did, but I came back. I forgot where the church is.
This has got to be the wordiest Peanuts Sunday ever.
It is very wordy. That line from Luke is also in the famously in the Christmas special.
And once again, is that the first time he did a direct quote? He kept
someone should do a podcast and find that out.
I know.
I believe so, because I don't think I've ever seen the quotation marks for one thing around anything that he referenced. So this is an example of a direct biblical quote. And also a pretty funny strip. It is really wordy, but he does manage to make nice drawings. I love the little drawings of Linus framed against the night sky.
Yeah.
I said it's snowing. I assume it's snowing, but you really can't tell if it's snow or stars because
it's Charles Schultz.
It's just blobs of white, but it's a beautiful strip.
Yeah.
And that's 1959, folks. What do you think?
Well, I want to say, Michael, I think you have run to something. With
you
summertime,
think so?
Summertime. 1958.
Whoa, wow. That must be it. So if we had to sing that, would it track?
No.
No, not quite.
There aren't enough supper times in there.
Yeah, it's supper time. Yeah, no. It actually falls apart on the fifth word, but that's okay. I definitely still think it's a reference. All right, so guys, 1959, clearly that was a banner year. Michael, what are your thoughts summing this thing up?
Can't get better. But it will.
And yet it will. I don't understand it. I think I understand it less the more I read it.
We were lucky to be alive to witness this.
It is always nice when like there's something that you're, oh, yeah, I got to see Peanuts. That was pretty good, you know?
Yeah.
Well, of course, you're the only one who actually got to see this stuff live, but.
That's true. But this is, we've discussed this before. I think this is one of the few occasions in the history of popular entertainment where the best and the most popular were the same thing.
Such and a magic thing when that happens.
Yeah, I mean, it happened with the Beatles, happened with Peanuts. I can't think of too many other examples.
Mm-mm. No, and not just being the most popular, but being global phenomenons. Everybody agreed these things were good.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, people say it can never happen again because of the fragmentation of media. And maybe it can't, but maybe it can. You know, why couldn't it? I'm sure there were people saying it couldn't happen now, you know, back in the here in 1959, but it did.
Yeah. But if it happened today, none of us would notice.
Oh, the three of us? Well, no, but, you know, people would.
Somebody maybe, but not me.
Harold, what are your thoughts of 1959?
Well, like I said, this is the first year in reading all of these strips. There are a lot of things in the earlier years where it reminded me of the feeling I had as a kid reading Peanuts, but this whole year reminded me of the feeling of reading Peanuts. It just has the tone that I remember. I like the subtleties that he's adding. I like that the characters they're not just so opposed to each other and one gets the upper hand and then the other is let down or angry or depressed. It's like these characters are living side by side with one another. They get things out of each other that just by being together, this little community. And that's, I think, part of the magic of the strip that really was important to me as a shy kid growing up in the suburbs of Rochester, New York, when most of this was being experienced by me in the deepest way I remember. This is, I know I said that Linus was more real to me than my next door neighbor. And I think I'm starting to remember more why that was as I read these.
Because your neighbor was a ghost? Is that what the reveal is going to be?
Look, it was Casper, the Casper family.
Linus literally was more real.
Yeah, the old Granville house next door was, no, it was really, you know, when I see the relationships grow and develop as we read this year by year, the richness is really coming out in 1959. And I related to, and I think I was learning from things that these characters were, how they were interacting with one another and how they felt about one another and the impact of one another on each other. And I think that's really, that's not grammatically correct either, but I just liked the strip because of that, because I was like, it was an internal world that was just an internal world for me, but somehow I was getting to experience the internal world of multiple people and seeing how, what they would say, what they would think. It was like I was living that out in a way that I didn't know how to live out as a kid, but I was getting to experience it through the mind of Charles Schulz, which is absolutely remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, that's what great art can do. And if there's one thing I hope this podcast proves is that Peanuts is in fact great art. Michael, I think in one of the other episodes we were talking, he said something like, not to slight Picasso, but this is the greater achievement. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe we are in the minority of thinking that way, but this is one of the great works of Western art. I really do believe that.
Yep.
Hey, and if you believe that, why don't you continue this conversation with us? You can check us out on social media. On both Instagram and Twitter, we're at Unpack Peanuts. And you can also follow us at our website, unpackingpeanuts.com, where you can vote on your favorite for strip of the year for 1959. And speaking of, guys, what are your strips of the year for 1959? Michael, why don't you go first?
Well, it's not the funniest. It's not the best drawn. But I got to go with the psychiatrist booth. March 27th.
Well, that is the correct answer.
Yeah, thank you.
You can't beat that. I'm going to have to pick something else now, but you cannot beat that. How about you, Harold?
Yeah, this is tough, and it's going to get tougher over the next few years, I think. But the one I picked, I guess because it does seem to symbolize a major shift in how I view Charlie Brown.
Oh, no, you're going to pick my second choice. Go ahead.
Well, maybe, I don't know, it was a rich year. We'll see. It's when Charlie Brown is writing his pencil pal about Sally. And then in the middle of it, he breaks off to prepare the bottle for Sally. That strip really defines a new Charlie Brown, and one I respect. And with, for all of his faults, he's just coming to be this richer, more admirable character. And that strip kind of embodies and also reflects the introduction of Sally, which is important this year.
Yeah, well, that's the second correct choice. Boy, I hate going last. Whoever said I got to go last, I never get to.
You
it.
Did.
I am. Oh, you know what, Michael? I think you just solved a lot of my problems. Whose fault is that? You're like my Lucy. Oh, thank you. And for that, I am going to go with Destructive Criticism.
Yes.
Because that's just a great line. That is. May 11th.
You're not going to give it to the Great Pumpkin?
No, because there are better Great Pumpkin strips later.
Yeah.
Even though, obviously, we have to give a nod to the first Great Pumpkin, because that is a classic. So, guys, all right, this was it. This was 1959. We are about to head into the 60s. And can things get better? Well, there's only one way to find out. Join us back here next week for Unpacking Peanuts. Until then, I'm Jimmy for Michael and Harold. Be of good cheer.
Yes, be of good cheer.
Be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
You blockhead!